tonight on Arena. Joy and heartbreak in equal measure in Still, the story of actor Michael J. Fox, and musician Dan Fitzpatrick of Bad Hands plays live in studio. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Still, a Michael J. Fox movie incorporates documentary, archival and scripted elements and recounts Fox's extraordinary story in his own words. The improbable tale of an undersized kid from a Canadian army base who rose to the heights of stardom in 1980s Hollywood. The account of Fox's public life is shown alongside his never-before-seen private journey, including the years that followed his diagnosis at the age of 29 with Parkinson's disease. The film explores what happens when an incurable optimist confronts an incurable disease. With me in studio is John McGuire, who's been watching Still. And, and even as I say those words, I find myself just filling up with this huge emotion. This hugely emotional film.
It's a very poignant film, Sean. Yeah, very, very poignant. We know Michael J. Fox. I grew up with him. Mm. And the first time you see him on screen here, you kind of catch your breath because we know he was diagnosed at the age of 29 with Parkinson's disease. We know that's a degenerative disease and he is going to get worse. Mm. He's in his early 60s. Now he's 61, coming 62. And the first time you see him, he's got the tremors and the trembles that you associate with the disease. Mm. His voice is slightly slurred. He does catch himself on certain words. His memory isn't what it used to be. He gets distracted, but it's his physical appearance has changed so much over the last couple of years. And we all get older, but this part of the disease. And when, as Davis Guggenheim is the director of the film, who does a fabulous job here, as he explains the degeneration in Fox, and as Fox, explains how things went from a little tremble in his finger to this full body Parkinson's. This is the glory in the film, is that we are remembering him. Yeah. We are constantly reminded of this little energetic ball of energy that took Hollywood, it took him a while to get going, but once he got going, he owned the 1980s. He says it himself at one stage.
Yeah. Actually,
I was bigger than bubblegum, which is a great line.
Yeah, let's have a listen to him quite early on in the film, in fact, where he is explaining that first moment when he realised there was something up. So this is the older Fox saying this, voice-overing this as we're watching all sorts of images on the screen, and a little bit of language just towards the end of this clip as well.
I woke up with a ferocious hangover. I placed my left hand across the bridge of my nose to block the sunlight. A moth's wing fluttered against my right cheek. I put my hand in front of my face so I could finger flick the little beastie across the room. That's when I noticed my pinky. Auto-animated. For Christ's sake, it's just your freaking finger. But it wasn't mine. Shit. It was somebody else's. Had I hit my head? The tape of the previous night's events was grainy at best. Woody Harrelson was in the bar the night before. Maybe we'd had one of our legendary drunken fights. But I couldn't recall any such melee. I did recall how my bodyguard had to prop me up against the doorframe while he fumbled the key into the door of my suite. I was in an acid bath of fear and professional insecurity. The trembling was a message from the future.
That's Michael J. Fox in the opening scenes there of the film we're talking about this evening, Still, a Michael J. Fox movie. And that last line gives us a sense of just how clever the storytelling is in this, John McGuire, who's been watching it for us. You know, he says, this was a message from the future. And of course, we're into Back to the Future. We're into all of that kind of, the way they mix the time frame between him telling us about something right now today and then looking back at that extraordinary success. Yeah. It didn't all start swimmingly easily.
For his lap. No, he was 18. He dropped out of high school in Edmonton.
With his father's blessing, it has to be said.
Who actually drove him to LA and set him up in a little apartment. But it took him 3 years before he got a proper job. Mm. And he had sold most of his possessions at that stage and he was living off half nothing. And in the documentary, he talks about the getting his first big break as Alex Keaton, this ambitious kind of Reagan-era young lad, a teenage, entrepreneurial teenager who's into everything, who's the son of two hippies in the sitcom Family Ties. And it was, you know, square kids, hippie parents was the pitch for Family Ties, which ran for seven seasons until 1989 and was shown all over the world, and it made him a star. He won a couple of Emmy Awards, he won a Golden Globe for it. The parents were supposed to be the focus of the show, but himself and his co-star Justine Bateman were so popular that they took it over. And most significantly for Fox, on that set, he met and fell in love with Tracy Pollan, who was another actor on the show in the later seasons. And they got married, and they've been married now for 34 years, and they have four kids together.
Yeah, and it really is the yin and yang in the case of the tumor, the chalk and cheese, whatever way you want to put it. I mean, she was the New York theatre actor.
Yeah, intellectual and
really
and
serious background. And that was kind of reflected in the character that she played in the sitcom as well.
He was the scrappy Canadian kid who wasn't a teenager at all. He was 22 at this stage, you know. But he was small. He was always small. He makes a lot of fun out of himself for his height, his diminutive height in this documentary.
And he wasn't. He had to work hard. One of the executives, and it's good that they allow you, the executive, to do that. Says, "Nah, he's good. He's very good. He's honest.
That's funny.
He'll never be on a lunchbox.
He'll never be on a lunchbox." And then he sends him the lunchbox because Family Ties was massive. And at that same time, as they were filming the last couple of seasons of Family Ties, he got a job. He took over from Eric Stoltz famously on Back to the Future, and Back to the Future became, you know, the defining film of the 1980s, if you ask me. And this is at a time when we didn't have a weekly blockbuster in the cinema with digital effects and everything like that. The landscape was very different, and Back to the Future became a global sensation and made him an absolute star.
And he was doing shooting Back to
the
Future
the
and
night,
Family Ties at the
day
same
night,
time. And again, let's listen to a clip which gives a sense of the kind of the ridiculous
the
schedule
he was putting himself under was absolutely insane. Yeah.
Yeah. But, so let's listen to how they tell the story.
Wait a minute, Doc. Are you telling me that you built a time machine out of a DeLorean?
I would work on the film until just before sunrise. At that point, I'd climb into the back of a production van with a pillow and a blanket, and yet another Teamster driver would take me home again. I'd catch 2 or 3 hours of sleep before Teamster driver number one would reappear at my apartment, let himself in with the key I'd provided, brew a pot of coffee, turn on the shower, and then start the whole process all over again.
And that's how they tell the story of how Michael J. Fox managed to shoot Back to the Future and Family Ties all at the same time. One of them happening at night, the other one happening during the day. But the way they do that on screen, you get a sense of it even from the audience. It's very clever, John.
Very clever, Sean, because firstly, they're allowing Fox to tell his own story. That's really important. Mm. And rather than rely on a raft of talking heads in interviews from friends and colleagues and all the people he's worked with over the years, he tells his own story. And secondly, as you've heard there, but you will see that they use clips from the films and TV shows he was in to illustrate that narrative. So every time he tells us a little story, Guggenheim and, I can only presume, a team of editors have gone through literally every time Michael J. Fox has appeared on screen and found the right little tiny moment and strung them together to construct this narrative.
For example,
when I was in awe of some of these sequences. There's three or four big standouts and you're like, that is really smart.
Yeah, there's one section where, for example, he comes in and he's working in a diner. Alex B. Keaton is working in a diner and the owner of the diner says, "You've got two jobs now?" And suddenly he's saying, "And I've got to go. Got to go to my second one." Yeah. And he's off to the set of Back to the Future. It's really clever editing.
Yeah, it's really smart. And it's really engaging. And there's an energy here. Fox had always a terrific screen presence, partly because of that kind of athleticism that he had as a little guy, honed by playing hockey, as he says, on the streets of Edmonton, and partly from this kind of internal energy that he could translate into physical comedy. And he really had that skill and had that talent. And directors spotted that quick enough. And Back to the Future has a lot of physical comedy in it. And by the time that it was released, he'd had Teen Wolf, he had Doc Hollywood, there was The Secret of My Success, which was somewhat less successful, but the best film that he made in this era, which they don't really talk about in the documentary, there's clips from it, is Brian De Palma's war film, Casualties of War, the Vietnam film, where he was cast against type as this moralistic GI who blows the whistle on a war crime committed. And it's one of the most punishing and morally complex films about men at war ever made. And you kind of wish, watching the tiny clips that they have, that Fox had done more of that kind of work.
It was a serious drama as well. But the real heart, the beating heart of the film is Fox speaking directly to the camera today in his current state. And you know, his physical state is quite upsetting to watch and to see.
Yeah.
And the family that are supporting you. It's an extraordinary story, his wife and his two children.
There's huge heart here, and it, you know, the poignancy when you watch them all together. As he says himself, you don't die from Parkinson's, but you die with Parkinson's. And there is that kind of mortality hanging over him, even though at 62 he's got, you know, life left in him yet. And he still has that energy. We watch him in his physical in his physio sessions with his trainer. Some of that stuff was really, really hard to watch, when he's fighting to try to take steps, fighting to relearn how to walk. He's fighting the degeneration of his body. He suffers falls. There's a great scene right at the start of the film where he actually falls in front of Guggenheim's camera, and some passerby helps pick him up, and he's got a great one-liner, which I'm not going to spoil, but he's quick as a whip, that kind of wit. But what comes out of it, and the irony of it, when he started with Family Ties and he ends up with his family, he's got his kids around him, he's got a wife around him, and that unit together of caregivers, that is so heartening.
Listen to the theme from Family Ties now, with what you've just said about what we actually see. Listen to the lyrics of this and the story that he's telling about the care he's getting from his family in real life.
Bet we've been together for a million years.
And I bet we'll be together for a million more.
Oh, it's like I started breathing on the night we kissed. And I can't remember what I ever did before. What would we do, baby?
Just those lyrics of what would we do, baby, without us? This is from, that's the theme music, obviously, for Family Ties. I don't think we hear the entire thing
in
the film, but those lyrics kind of fit perfectly with where the family are at now. Mostly we see it from Michael J. Fox's point of view. Do we get much from the family and how they're dealing with the situation?
Certainly do in the later stages, because Guggenheim, it becomes very intimate, really. He spends a lot of time with them in their home. Tracy Pollan, his wife, accompanies him to some of his physical health sessions, and they go to a doctor's appointment, and they, you know, it's warts and all. So he's telling you exactly what's happening. Nothing is hidden. Exactly his state of health, exactly his prognosis, the kind of therapies that he has to endure, and they're difficult, very difficult and hard on him, but just as hard on her as his primary caregiver and his wife and their kids. And the kids are just as optimistic and bright and smiley as you'd expect Michael J. Fox's children to be. But his son is 29 now, which is the same age as Fox was when he was first diagnosed. And there's layer upon layer of poignancy and heart here, Sean. I mean, the deeper you get into it, the more you watch, and the more time you spend with somebody that you spent so much time with yourself over the years in the cinema, you really do feel for them so much. And for anybody who's dealing with somebody who has Parkinson's or Alzheimer's or any of those kind of degenerative diseases, the your admiration for caregivers would really be enhanced by watching this film.
Is it an unreserved recommendation, John?
Oh yeah, this is really great, and it's great because of Fox. It's great because it's him. It's not,
he's still hilarious, you know, and he's still heartbreaking.
Funny. He's still smart. He's still as quick as a whip, and he still has you know, himself, he's still there. You just have to go looking for him a little deeper.
Yeah, and it's a great watch. I totally agree with
Apple TV, Sean, Friday night.
That's John McGuire telling us about Still at the name of the film, and a great title with all those layers of meaning.
Again, more layers, exactly.
He's still himself, ultimately, is what's been said there, I guess. Still will be available on Apple TV from this Friday, May the 12th. It's rare enough that as you release album number 2, album number 3 is already in the can, but that was the case for Bad Hands, the stage name of musician and composer Dan Fitzpatrick. Last spring, he released his second Bad Hands album, Far Away, having recorded his third album, The Wheel, 3 months previously. That album was released on Friday. The Wheel represents a departure for Bad Hands in terms of how he works in studio, inspired by watching a very long documentary about a certain beat quartet from Liverpool. More on that shortly. But first of all, Dan Fitzpatrick and his Bad Hands collaborator, Dave Talpi, are with me in studio this evening. And we're going to have a chat with Dan shortly. But first of all, let's hear the track Bad Dreams.
I could be the ballast in your bad dreams when everything else is pulling you down. When you feel the fever burning in you, I could be your prescription drug.
Bad Dreams, the title of the song there from Bad Hands. Bad Hands being the, I suppose, the music name of Daniel Fitzpatrick. And Dave Tapley, who was with him on guitar there as well. I was joking about getting the P and the L mixed up, and then I did it. Dave Tapley, playing alongside Dan there. I mentioned, Dan, at the beginning there about Bad Hands, or about the latest album, The Wheel, was in process while album 2 was kind of making its way. This is all very Back to the Future.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, I mean, it was pretty much done. Mm. Like, it was pretty much completed by the time the second album came out. So when the second album came out, I already had an eye on this one. Yeah, yeah. But it was all done pretty impromptu, like you said. So it was
the Beatles documentary.
It was. We all saw it. All the band, I think, was it like December? December the year before, and then we recorded the album in January. But it was, I found the documentary just kind of, there was something really cathartic about it. It was
this was the Get Back documentary,
the big long one on the Beatles.
I
wished it was longer. It was, I mean, what is it, 9 hours or something? But it was there was something about it I just found, I found seeing the band struggle so much in the studio, there was something incredibly inspiring about that, because they're just floundering really for a lot of it, but then they pull it together just by kind of grafting and sticking with it.
Yeah, and I guess it's a real lesson in some ways when you look at them making that album. There are times when the songs that we eventually got on the album are miles away from what was on the album.
That's
just
it.
One little tweak or one little suggestion from somebody else and hey, presto, you have a new song.
Exactly. Like, I think, for example, Don't Let Me Down, you know, when they're playing that at the start, it sounds pretty poor, and you can see the band aren't really into it, you know. And then when Billy Preston first comes in and he just adds a little flourish of the keys, it's like the curtains are just opened and
suddenly
they all
the
just
song
kind of,
opens
yeah and they yeah. all light up, and it's like it all makes sense, and it kind of gives you hope, because you're like, sometimes it's like that when you bring a song in with the band and you're working on it and it's like, oh, I thought there was something in this, but it seems to be going nowhere. But if you just stick with it, sometimes, you know, something happens and brings it to life.
And that is, I think, is it safe to say that usually when you would go into studio, you have it plotted out, you have exactly your plan in place and you follow that?
Yeah. I'd say with the previous two albums, I was maybe a bit more of a control freak. Like, I would have demoed it to death, you know. I'd tried everything and then go in and be recording layers and, you know, throwing everything at it. But with this album, we kind of went in with the band. And again, I think it was probably helped by the fact that the songs were, in their early stages. They were close to finish, but I hadn't had a chance to, you know, demo them or anything like that. So I just went in and let the band shape it.
I see a mixture of a wry smile on your face there, Dave, when Daniel mentioned about Control Freak, and then you were nodding.
He was not a Control Freak at all.
Not on this one.
Yeah, no. I had less to do with the
And were the band much more? Did you feel much more involved then, Dan? Or I beg your pardon, Dave. And do you think the others felt much more involved in the making of this album than you had done previously?
Well, I will say the small amount of demoing you did do, Daniel, you left a lot to the imagination, which was where we were able to take it when we did do that, you know, Beatles style, get in the studio and work it out. You know, sometimes when you do demo a track to death, there's nowhere for it to go, but there was mountains of
you get attached. Sometimes you record a demo of things and then you just get immediately attached to the things that are on it, and it's very hard to see the song any other way. But with this one, it was just go in and let the band sort of dictate what the songs were.
Yeah, and it struck me too that, you know, as you're playing it this evening, it's two acoustic guitars. There's more production than that on the album.
Yeah.
A lot of piano, a lot of other instruments in there too.
Yeah.
But I guess they started out in a very bare state, didn't they?
Yeah, most of them would have started out on piano, more so than the previous albums.
Because it's quite a lot of piano on the album.
Yeah, I would have kind of written nearly every song on the piano in this one. And the way we did it in the studio was me just sitting at a grand piano. Most of them was Dave playing the bass, and then Ken on the drums, Chris playing guitar. Mm. And yeah, we just did it fairly live.
What about the other side of things, which is another I suppose string to the fiddle, which is the fact that Bad Hands music has featured in the TV show Smother. Separate to that, scoring for television is now a big part of your career. In fact,
getting bigger.
Yeah, you worked on Tommy Tiernan's Epic Westwood thing. Was that one of the early ones?
A couple of tracks on that, yeah. And then recently the Ireland's Wild Islands series, which. Just the last episode aired on Sunday, but I think I think that one repeats on RT2 tomorrow at 8:30.
Yeah.
And it's worth checking. It's on the RTE player. It's a great, great series.
Yeah, it looks at the islands literally around the country.
Mainly the Atlantic ones.
Yeah.
But it's great. I mean, it's incredible footage, and it was really nice to get to put some music to it.
Tommy's Epic West and now Ireland's Wild Islands. It seems like you're
the West. Well, I do. I mean,
the West is alive in your music.
Yeah.
Okay, let's have a listen to a little bit of what you did for Ireland's Wild Islands. This is a track called Seals, a little bit of it. Just a little flavour of the soundtrack, that's for the episode called Seals, or a section of Ireland's Wild Islands that I presume features Seals.
It features Seals. I don't try and overthink the names.
It struck me though, I mean, there is one fully instrumental track on the current album, The Wheel, but when you're writing in that fashion, is it a very different process when you have visuals that you're matching into, as opposed to a song that possibly needs to stand on its own feet really by itself, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's a fairly different process. Like, this is more, like any of the songs I have with the band are generally things that have kind of just come to me naturally, you know, whereas this is a bit more you sit down and you've got a... you're somewhat working to order, you know. Some of the tracks that I go on the things are pieces that I would have written more organically, say, you know, randomly, and then I fit them in. But sometimes you are literally just looking at the, you know, you're looking at the footage and trying to come up with something very specific to work. To
yeah,
that.
You're so told we want a minute and 20 seconds of music here,
exactly.
So you know that dictates a certain amount. And was that a lone ranger type of activity? Were you there just totally by yourself, or were others involved?
Yeah, it would definitely be much more so than the band side of Bad Hands. I'd do like a lot of the stuff myself, and then Aoife Ruth, who also plays in the band, she would do all the violin and all the strings. So a lot of it is me. I'll do piano and whatever else. And then I get Aoife in and she'll layer up a load of a load of strings and make it sound nice.
And you have more islands again involved in the PBS show that you're working on the score for. That's for the US. It's called Islands of Ireland. So,
well, actually, that's the same.
It's
the same one.
Yeah, it's a reworking of this one.
Exactly. I think it is going to go international.
Right. Well, that's a nice aspect to it to have. I'm guessing then when you head out on the gigs, the fact that the current album, The Wheel, had that kind of live recording feel to it, it's probably easy enough to take out on the road, is it?
It's been great. We did the first two gigs at the weekend, Dublin and Derry, and then this weekend we're playing Newbridge on Friday, and then Saturday night we're playing a lovely venue in Kinsale called Prim's Bookstore. So we're looking forward to a little trip down to Cork.
So you're going to accept the South and the West now.
We are.
Part of your musical journey.
We're open to anyone who'll have us.
Right. Thanks for coming in to both of you this evening. That's Dan Fitzpatrick and Dave Tapley along with him there. Bad Hands will play live dates, as Dan was telling us there, in Flanagan's of Newbridge this Friday, Prim's Bookshop in Kinsale on Saturday. And later this month, you'll get them at the Cavan Arts Festival, Saturday the 20th of May, Kildare and the Big Style Atlantic Lounge in Louisburg on Saturday the 27th. Album The Wheel is out now. Bealtaine Poetry Line is an invitation to poetry lovers to get a phone poem call from a famous Irish poet. You can sign up for free, and one of the following poets, Thomas McCarthy, Jane Clark, Micheál McCann, Rachel Hegarty or Molly Toomey, will call you to read two or three of their poems to you down the line. It's all part of a collaboration between Age and Opportunity and Poetry Ireland, and I'm delighted to be joined from our Cork studio this evening by Molly Toomey and Thomas McCarthy. Molly, the whole idea of somebody phoning you up and just reading a delicious poem to you down the line straight into your own ear. There's something wonderfully intimate and communicative about that.
Yeah, I totally agree. Yeah, I think it'll be fantastic. It's my first time taking part and I'm really interested just to chat to people about poetry in their daily lives and their lived experiences of poetry, and of course then to read and share poems as well.
So what do people do, Thomas? Do they get in touch with the Bealtaine Poetry Line to kind of put their name forward and say, I want to call? And do they choose the poet?
They can mention a preference. But it's mainly people contact the line and say that they want to hear a poet, that they want to listen to a poet. And then we will phone them on the day. Are in a succession of days, actually.
And Molly, in terms of the sort of poems that you choose, do you take any guidelines from the person who's phoned up, or have you kind of a set number that you want to share with them yourself? How are you doing it?
Yes, so generally we'll read 2 to 3 poems, and so people do have a choice to put a preference of a poem forward. Perhaps that's a poem that one of the poets that are taking part have written, or perhaps it's an old beloved poem, and they can put that forward when they ring the hotline, essentially. It'll be open again on Wednesday and Thursday this week from 10 to 5 for people to ring in and essentially order or their takeaway in the form of a poem. So,
and you have one of your poems. Is this kind of one that you're hoping people will ask for, or that you might try to sell to them on the day?
Yeah, I suppose I won't have any kind of belief that anyone out there is hoping that I will read any of my poems to them. But this is, this poem that I wouldn't mind reading this evening is called Kinsale. And I suppose essentially why I kind of pick it out as one I might potentially read during the poetry line is because it's one of the least sad poems in my book. And I'm hoping not to make anyone's day worse, essentially. So it's probably one of the most hopeful poems in my collection. And it's kind of a love poem, but there are some serious topics in it as well.
Well, the collection that you're speaking about is Raised Among Vultures, which certainly has a kind of a frightening ring to it, doesn't it?
Yeah, of course.
Kinsale sounds like an altogether softer option than the Vultures. So let's hear the poem, Kinsale.
Perfect. So Kinsale. Mostly I love you when I'm giving out about the concrete garden of a single-storey house where marigolds, foxgloves and asters could shelter honeybees. A pond could refuge netherjacks and newts, or an evergreen hold red squirrels, the nest of a collared dove. If we owned that bungalow, I'd garnish our soup with wild garlic, caramelise our onions, honey glaze fresh beets. Maybe we could raise hens, quail or geese. Picture us waking up to the Caddywakes' song, a stroll from the port where we greet by name the fishmonger, dog walkers and rose-scented florist. How unfair to be stuffed in an apartment we can't afford, stacks of Tupperware leaning on cabinet doors. You listen to me bark on and on like a city fox before you reply that the slope from the porch to the road looks fit for a wheelchair, fibromyalgia or brittle bones. How can anything flourish or live if we don't allow space for one another to grow? My God, I'd create an Eden on our front lawn.
That's Molly Toomey reading her poem Kinsale. It's from her collection Raised Among Vultures, and it sounds as if it might be one of the poems that Molly will use as part of the Beultna Poetry Line, which is this invitation to poetry lovers to get a phone poem call from poets, Irish poets who are part of the whole project. Molly is one of them, and Thomas McCarthy, who's also in our Cork studio this evening, is another of them. Just on that poem, Molly, I love how you move from this concrete garden. Is that what you have out in front, or did have out in front of the house at one stage? There was no space to grow anything, but you want to have Eden in there if you could manage it.
So the poem is basically, it's about me and my partner took a day trip to Kinsale, and we saw this house with a garden in front of it that just didn't have anything growing, and I got really frustrated. It's me and my partner don't live together. We can't afford to have somewhere like that. And I think I was just annoyed, and I was probably putting my frustration on the fact that the garden just didn't have, you know, any kind of wildlife in it. And then this poem kind of came out from the fact that my partner turned to me and he said, you know, obviously this garden is built for someone who has accessibility needs. So I was very, very quickly, you know, had to turn around on what I was saying. And then I suppose ultimately I realised, you know, how my partner teaches me to be more aware and to see the world with more awareness and not just kind of see it with my own vision, thinking perhaps slightly selfishly, or thinking only with what I want or need, and thinking of everyone.
Absolutely. So. I suppose a poem would often do that, Thomas, in that, you know, it's something, maybe you react to something in a moment, but as you write the poem, you learn something yourself. In your case, it was Newark Airport, I think, that was part of the inspiration, or an event that happened to you there. Maybe you'd set that up for us before you read the poem.
I was in Newark, New Jersey, one of the airports of New York City, as you say. It was a good while ago now, but I remember I came in early on an early flight and I was waiting for a connection to Pittsburgh, actually. And then there was a commotion at the kind of check-in desk, and there was an announcement that for a volunteer, would somebody be prepared to give up their seat? And definitely, I went up straight away. I was in no hurry whatsoever. I never am. So I went up and I said, look, I'll give up my seat. I said, if you have a flight within the next hour afterwards. And they said, yeah, it was one in 3/4 of an hour. So it was a man who was desperate. He had missed his connection. He had come in from Chicago and he was going to a conference to make a presentation on behalf of his company. It was absolutely essential. But the company had developed a new product and he had just missed the connection. And I thought, God, you know, we all miss our connections at some stage, including our connections with inspiration in poetry. And I thought of a poem I'd read a while back. It was a poem on a basking shark by Norman McCaig, the great Scottish poet. And all of it came together in the poem.
Let's hear it then. The poem is called Changing Planes at Newark.
Changing Planes at Newark. After this oceanic struggle on the crowded concourse, I let go of air rage and begin to sing above my full New York breakfast and water with ice. I've been upgraded to first class because of my no particular hurry. I gave way to a man with expensive bags, to a man of worry, his tale of lost connections and a business deal in jeopardy. How could I also not feel the force of human empathy? This is the American life, a Newark quandary at 7:30 a.m. Though not in the selling business, I can feel the pain of turning up too late with an idea, of just reaching a conference room cleared of those who might have bought into the one brilliant pitch that flew from Chicago overnight. I may have landed just too late as well, the poem inside me missing its distant gate, to sit here as resolute as old Norman McCaig, diminished as a small bairn in a basking shark's wake.
And that's Thomas McCarthy there reading his poem Changing Planes at Newark. And similarly, I'm struck there by how there's a kind of an empathy in it, and maybe considering somebody else in a way that Molly had done in her poem as well, Thomas. But I'm also struck by the lack of deadline that you express in that poem. Given that we spoke back in January, it was 2022, wasn't it, about your diaries, Poetry,
right.
Memory and the Party.
That's right.
1974 to 2014. Where are we at now in terms of, have you put any kind of deadline on yourself in sending, giving us some new material, or what way are you on that one?
Well, I have a habit of arriving very, very early when I'm travelling. It infuriates my wife because she thinks I completely overdo it. I am happy to come 3 hours early to any airport and just watch people. But sometimes I even come an hour early to take a bus. But it means I'm never really in a hurry.
And does that mean that there's no rush on you to give us some new poetry?
The poetry sort of has its own kind of timeline, really. It comes and goes. If I don't write poems, I don't worry, because I really do feel when it comes to writing that, you know, a fallow field yields a rich crop eventually. So the poems are there somewhere and they'll just come in their own time.
Yeah.
So you don't have to worry about that too much. Certainly not in poetry. Maybe if you're a novelist working to a deadline, it would be different. But poetry, I think you have to 95% trust the process, you know.
Sit and wait in some way, shape or form. How are you on that front, Molly? Are you as philosophical and as patient as Thomas seems to be? Have you anything to follow up Raised Among Vultures with?
I think I'm probably more of a frustrated writer, you know. I probably don't trust the process as much and probably kind of force myself to sit down and write when it's not working. But that's hopefully something that I'll get better at, you know. But I'm writing all the time still, even if it's not good and it's not coming. I'm still there trying to get something out of myself. That's hopefully something I'll get better at.
Well, look, it was good to speak with both of you, and thanks so much for sharing your thoughts with us this evening. That's Molly Toomey and Thomas McCarthy speaking to us from our Cork studios. And to find out more about the Bealtaine Festival and indeed the poetry line that Molly and Thomas were telling us about, go to bealtaine.ie. Tomorrow night, the Lighthouse Cinema will screen Marlon Riggs' 1989 film essay, Tongues Unite, Tongues Untied. The groundbreaking film explored what it meant to grow up gay in black America, or as Riggs asserted, to shatter the nation's brutalising silence on matters of sexual and racial difference. The screening is part of a UCD event exploring how arts programming can reflect society in a world that more and more shapes experiences through identity. Delighted to be joined in studio this evening by Rico Johnson Sinclair, programmer with Outfest and the British Film Institute Race Equality Lead. Let's have a listen to Tongues Untied, the very opening section, because it makes a very potent point. Silence is normally a frightening thing on radio. This is a very interesting way of doing it in this film.
Black men today, every day.
I strive to appear strong and silent. I learn to ingest hatred at a geometric rate and to count silently to 10,000, 10 million. But as I've learned to mute my cries of anguish, so have I learned to squelch my exclamations of joy. What remains is the rap.
Silence is my shield.
It crushes.
Silence is my cloak.
It smothers.
Silence is my sword.
It cuts both ways.
Silence is the deadliest weapon.
What legacy is to be found in silence?
How many lives lost?
What future lies in our silence?
How much history lost?
So seductive its grip.
This silence.
Break it.
Our silence.
Loose the tongue.
Justify.
Let's end the silence, baby.
Together.
Now.
There you go. Part of the opening section of Marlon Riggs' 1989 film essay, Tongues Untied. And as I said, that film will be shown tomorrow night in the Lighthouse as part of this UCD event, exploring arts programming and how it can reflect society. As the Outfest director and the British Film Institute's lead on matters of racial inequality, Rico Johnson Sinclair, is with me in studio. That's such a potent clip just in and of itself. But tell us a little bit, before we get into the specifics of it, about Marlon Riggs and that groundbreaking film from 1989, Rico.
So it's one of, I would say it's one of Marlon Riggs' seminal works. It definitely dictates his vision from then on. And it speaks so eloquently to the queer black experience. I remember the first time I saw the film, and it allowed me to really think about a lot of the internalised racism, internalised and homophobia that I'd endured as like someone who has a duality in identity, being too black to be queer and being too queer to be black. It helped me figure out a lot of my identity. And so I really see this kind of narrative throughout his works from the very beginning to his last film, Black is Black Ain't. But he is actually, he sadly died shortly after this film. I think he lived for 2 years after that. He died from AIDS. And his last film, Black is Black Ain't, was actually done from his deathbed because he wanted to get out this narrative about anti-queerness inside the black community. And so this is really powerful because it speaks to a lived experience, but it does so through artist moving image, through poetry, through spoken word, during a time where those things were still beginning to flourish in the creative scene. And it also, the thing that I find most interesting about it is it's about black queerness, and it's by a black queer man. And a lot of the depictions of black queerness before this time, for example, Portrait of Jason by Shirley Clarke, it spoke about blackness, but from a very white lens. So it was a white filmmaker, a white documentary filmmaker who controlled the narrative. And actually that film, Portrait of Jason, is a really good example because they play the subject with alcohol, this black queer man who goes by Jason, who's a queer hustler. They play him with alcohol and ask him more and more questions, interrogating him to try and get him to unravel. And this is held with so much care. Tongues Untied is held with so much care.
Yeah.
And that is completely different from the films that came before it.
And the as I said, the effect on radio of just that heartbeat and absolutely nothing for it. It's a good minute that we're hearing nothing but the heartbeat. What are we seeing on screen when that heartbeat is beating? You had your eyes closed as you were listening.
So the opening of the film is depicted through the blackness of bodies, and I think that is during the time that this film was made, black bodies were still going through censorship on television and censorship in mainstream media. And so most of the film speaks to this unraveling of black bodies and the showing of black bodies. And so when we're talking about silence, we're talking about the silencing of image and also the silencing of narrative. And so that's depicted experimentally through the film in the beginning.
Yeah, and is it completely in monochrome, I think it is.
Yes,
entirely in monochrome the whole way through, and that brings a certain atmosphere to it as well. But what we get is, rather than talking heads or some kind of documentary, for the most part, it's spoken word and poetry that we get. Who are the writers here, and who are the performers, and what sort of things are they talking about?
Yeah, so there is Marlon Riggs and Essex Hemphill, and I've forgotten the last one.
Well, yeah, Essex Hemphill. Essex Hemphill is one of the big ones here, really, isn't he?
Yeah. Very famous for his work in spoken word and in poetry. And the three of them, I think the only time you ever see any colour throughout the whole entire film is when they're talking about their own experiences through spoken word and through poetry, looking at how they had to adapt to a new way of thinking because the kind of the vision of what is acceptable in terms of beauty is a very European standard, and that's what they've been conditioned to accept and to think about. So, yeah, it's a beautiful film.
I think you might have been thinking of Steve Langley, might have been one of the names you were searching for as well. He's vital. He's a big part of it, just searching to see where I had that written down for myself. But Steve Langley, both his poetry and he's one of the voices that we hear reciting as well. Mm-hmm. Let's listen to another clip here, and this is called Street Kissing. And really what we're dealing with here is play and street games. Homosexual feelings start to get some kind of expression, and in the midst of all of that, it's no time at all before the homophobia starts to kick in. Let's have a listen.
I'd heard my calling by age 6. We had a word for boys like me.
Punk.
Punk. Not because I played sex with other boys. Everybody on the block did that.
Punk.
But because I didn't mind giving it away. Now, other boys traded. You can have my booty if you give me yours. Mm-mm. But wait a minute now. If I go first, you went first last time. But I want to be the daddy. You the daddy all the time. But I want to be the daddy. I'm the daddy. Not me. I gave it up free.
Punk.
At age 11, we moved to Georgia. I graduated to new knowledge.
Homo.
You don't know how to kiss?
Homo.
My best friend asked, shocked. I didn't know what to do with a girl when I lost that spin the bottle.
Homo.
I'll show you, he said, his brown eyes inviting. We practiced kissing for weeks, dry, wet French, till his older brother called us a name.
Homo.
What's a homo? I asked.
Punk, faggot, freak.
I understood. We stopped kissing. Best friend became worst enemy.
And there we go, a clip from Tongues Untied, the 1989 film of Marlon Riggs, Rico Johnson Sinclair with me in studio talking about the film this evening. There's so much going on in even that small section. It's right across the 55 minutes of the film. There's an awful lot going on at certain times. But you're hearing what I'm guessing to a certain extent is some kind of internalised homophobia, but you're also getting the sense of homophobia from the wider community as well.
Yes, for sure. So I think this is a really indicative of the harm we do ourselves as a black queer community when we perceive ourselves not to be accepted by the wider society. And in recent years, I would say that the white gay community have gained some acceptance in the mainstream media, but there's a lot of internalised racism inside the LGBTQIA plus community at the moment. And this is really indicative.
So is it quite a segregated community even within all of that diversity?
In some ways,
segregated on racial and colour terms?
Yeah, racial, and also the segregation between the trans community and the wider LGBTQ community. There's definitely some discord inside the community. And you really feel that as a minority inside a minority. Mm. We talk about intersectional identities. It's when you are one thing and another thing. So you have a duality of identity.
Yeah, and you said this at the beginning. It was all, you're too black to be gay and too gay to be black. You can't be both things.
Exactly that.
Make your choice now.
It's beyond conceivable. And actually, when you're joining a community, you have to choose. You have to choose the queer community or the black community. Mm. You can't be both. And so I really feel like what I really love about this part of the film is it uses comedy for levity while still saying something really deep about the experiences of homophobia.
And it also uses comedy in another way. There's another clip that I want to play which uses comedy in the way that you kind of, it's funny, but it's not at all funny. So I think it's Eddie Murphy is the comedian that's on stage while we're hearing the voiceover explaining what the jokes that are being made and how you react if you're a black queer member of the audience.
Absolutely.
It's nothing like having a nation of fags looking for you.
Their jokes, their laughter, form a chorus of content.
Cars will come rushing across town, be woo, 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 woo. And it won't be no siren, it'll be a real fag sitting on the roof going, woo, woo, woo.
Each joke levels us a little more and we sit silently. Sometimes join in the laughter as if deep down we too believe we are the lowest among the low. No one will redeem your name, your love, your life, your manhood but you. No one will save you but you. Your silence is costing. Your silence is suicide.
And again, kind of blood-curdling line at the end, you know, your silence is suicide, you get a sense of just how difficult it is. Now, I asked you as we were listening to that, Rico, had you, even in 2023, is that type of experience still alive and well?
Absolutely, yeah. I think that it's even more prevalent now because we've gained some acceptance. So the LGBTQ community generally is seen as to be more accepted than it was before. We have more rights. But within that, I mean, lesbian women, because sexism exists within the community, lesbian women are often ostracized from white gay men. And then trans people, because of transphobia, are ostracized from the wider community. And black queer people and South Asian and Southeast Asian queer people are also ostracized because of racism. And what used to bind us together is that fight, the fight for equality. And that stopped us from turning ourselves in on each other.
Yeah.
And so now that some of those fights have been won, we're finding ourselves separated.
You have to start to find the intersectionality within that diverse community. It will make for a fascinating screening tomorrow night, and there'll be a Q&A afterwards, and I'm sure you'll be developing on some of the conversation we've had here this evening. Thanks so much for coming in to us. That's Rico Johnson Sinclair. Tongues Untied is part of the Creative Futures Academy's focus on diversity and inclusion. Will be screened at the Lighthouse Cinema tomorrow, Wednesday at 6:30, followed by a Q&A with Rico Johnson Sinclair. And that is our lot for this Tuesday evening. Paula Shields and Liam Murphy researched. Mark McGrath was on sound. Michelle Gibson was the broadcast coordinator. And tonight's programme was produced by Casey, who will be in the seat tomorrow night, and I will be back with you on Thursday. John Crean will be with you after the news.